went to Mexico with this book to open up a bookstore down there, and while I was in Mexico, my mother passed away with colon cancer. I came back to the States, and at the same time, my daughter had given me a call to ask me if I could come and give her a hand. She hadn't been feeling good. She had two small children. She's 29 years old. And in the hotel, can everyone hear me okay? Okay. I just want to make sure that they can hear. And Arvin and Carol, my goodness, their faces right here on the front row. At any rate, if you can, is that better? In the hotel room when we went to go and bury my mother, my daughter came out of the bathroom and had just found a lump. And so for the next year and a half, we battled breast cancer for her. Today she is alive. She's in remission. I'm very thankful. And during that period of time, my longtime friend that I had known at that point for something close to 6 years, I went to, hello, Dr. Lozier. I went to Illinois for the opening of a temple, and we met there. He's from California, and mine from Utah, you know, through the Midwest. We connected. And we knew there that it was time for us. Not only did we know it, but I think everybody that was around us knew it, and I don't know why it had taken us so long. So it's a situation where I never thought that I would probably make it back to Utah, because he was a dyed-in-the-wool California, you know, kind of a person, and he always thought that when he came to Utah, he was going home to California. But we came in over Christmas this year. And this time when we got ready to leave, she said, you know, he says, every time before, he said, I thought I was needing to go home. He said, but this time I feel like I'm leaving a big part of me here. So it turned out that the people that we were staying with is a real estate broker. It didn't take very long. You know, you get on the internet and look at the website and see the houses that are in the same price range as the house you got in California. Well, you know, miracles happen. We went back to California, called our broker, told him that we found a house in Utah that we kind of liked, asked him if it was a possibility. He called us back by noon that day, and he said, yes, sure, go ahead and buy the house. But that would leave us a house in two different states. So we called the realtor that had been recommended for us in California, and she came in on a Monday afternoon, came back on Tuesday morning to put the for sale sign in the front yard, and my husband called me. I was in Sacramento, and he said, it's sold. And I said, what's sold? He said, the house is sold. It's impossible. The for sale sign never made it to the front yard. The house was sold within less than 25 minutes. Escrow took 2 days. You know how long escrow takes? Escrow took 2 days. My husband had to come back to Utah for an interview here while he was gone. I packed up a house. The movers moved it out. The new people moved in. And when I picked him up on Saturday, we were homeless except for what we had here. Esco in Utah took 3 days for a house that had sat empty for a little over a year. So it's been a really interesting thing. I'm still hanging on by the seat of my pants because I have no idea, you know, what we're going to wind up doing here yet. I just know that we're here. Now that you have that short background history for the people who have known me and missed me, how many of you here have ever heard me speak before or are familiar with the book? You know, that's an appreciable amount, but I'm also interested in all the people who have not. How many have read the book? Good number of you on that one, too. I'll tell you that we have about 30 books here tonight, and then the book has gone from hardback to paperback, and we're just going to kind of phase it out someplace along. And then we'll wind up at some point in the near future putting out an anniversary edition, but we're going to let it go, you know, at this. So, with that in mind, in 1976, in October of that year, I was attending the American Floor. Okay.
No,
then. That doesn't work? Is that closer? Maybe I just need to pull it into my mouth. Is that better? Maybe I need to kind of hang into it. Is that?
Oh, Hello, hello, hello.
Oh, hey, this is better. I can run around now.
Uh-oh, we're in trouble.
I had been born with an arterial venial malformation. Is anyone familiar with that aside from the few doctors that are here? An AV malformation is where the veins and the arteries cluster together. If I remember right, before when we got these together, they kind of out-hump each other, didn't they? Yeah, we don't want to do that. Now, see, if you guys whisper in the front row, everybody can hear you. Be careful. It's an abnormal cluster of veins and arteries that kind of knot themselves together, and mine was just above the brain stem, just off the motor skill section of the brain. It's commonly found in women. Rarely do men, you know, rarely are men born with it. And usually someplace between the age of 30 to 50 years old, if a person is under any kind of stress, a vein can rupture. And that's what happened to me. At the time that this happened, I was attending the American Floral Arts School in Chicago with my 17-year-old cousin. And we were about 3 days away from graduation. She had never been to Chicago. I was in and out of Chicago all the time. So the sightseeing wasn't something that overly interested me. However, on that particular night, she did go out with several friends, and they did, you know, look around the city. I can remember walking back. It was about a 7-block walk from the school to the Ascot House where we were staying. And it was cold and had been kind of spitting snow. I felt like I was coming down with a good cold. And you know how you feel your sinuses kind of plugged up and your head feels a little foggy? Well, that's how I was. And so walking back, I remember walking through the Hilton, and I didn't want to stop anywhere. One of the other students had walked back with me. And, you know, when I got to the hotel room, or back to the Ascot House, to our room, I just lay down. I really didn't feel like eating. I just felt tired, and I thought, well, if I kind of rested, you know, maybe things would settle out, and I would feel a whole lot better. The next thing that I can remember is that shortly after that, he gave me a phone call, and he said he was walking down to get something to eat and asked me if I would like to go along. Well, I thought maybe if I got something to drink, I might be okay. And so I got out, and I made the short walk with him, and we went to the Hilton, got something. I remember getting something to drink. I don't remember eating anything. But someplace along in there, it's just about where my memory starts, you know, slipping. My cousin came in later that night. I had made it back to the room. But I had taken a shower, left the shower water running, the bath lights on, my clothes all over the floor, the windows were open, the radio was on, the TV was on, all the lamps in the room were on, and these are just things that were totally out of my character. So she went around and she shut everything off, and she got in bed. She said that she was just about half asleep when she heard me moan or kind of cry out, and she quickly turned on the light. And I was in the middle of a seizure. And so she just panicked. And she ran across the hall right quick. And I got to keep in mind that in the Ascot House, because there were international students that were in the school where I was attending, there were guards on every floor. And so she ran across, though, beating on the doors of other class members, wanting some, you know, somebody to help. When I came out of it, there was a French boy from Quebec, and he was on the phone calling for a physician in the best English he could pull together. And the other young man had my wallet shoved in my mouth, you know, because I was really chewing my mouth up. And the thing that I remember shortly after that is that the guard was in the room. He called for an ambulance, and, you know, it just seemed like seconds. I went into it. I had a second seizure, they tell me. And then the ambulance crew, the EMTs, were there, you know, to examine me. I just told them that I had a cold, that there really wasn't anything wrong with me. And in my mind, what I was thinking was, you know, ambulance city, away from home, it's going to cost me a king's fortune. I didn't want to wind up in a hospital someplace with people I didn't know. If I was really sick, I'd just go back, you know, to where I lived in the Midwest at that time, and I'd see my own family doctor. Well, they just stepped outside the door. You know, you can refuse them, but if they called a second time, they knew that if I had had three seizures that close, that I was going to have a fourth one. It wasn't going to be very far behind. The second time, or, you know, the second time they're called, they can take me against my will. So when he was very nice, he came back in. There's two emergency technicians, and they explained to me that something had happened. Well, but this time I was ill enough that I knew, you know, I realized that something was going on that I couldn't explain, and so I agreed that I would go with them, because what they said to me is, we'll just take you down, just kind of check you over, and if what you're saying is right, then, you know, we'll bring you back and everything will be okay. And so this is what I decided to go ahead and let them do. They wanted to know if I was Catholic or Protestant, and it really didn't make any difference to me, because at that time in my life I thought of myself as being an ecumenical person. And an ecumenical person can find God, they can find their faith, they can find peace by their creek that rolls through, you know, or just sitting peacefully listening to music like many of you do. You know, silently prayers, you know, poetry, any one of a number of things can bring you comfort, and that's about where I thought of myself as being. I had been raised in a very fundamental background, a very strict fundamental background, and so there was a lot of things, in, you know, that other people around me did that I did not do. But by the same token, what they decided to do was take me the 18 blocks to a Catholic hospital. Now, when they got me down into the lobby, I remember as I was getting off the elevator, someone asked what had happened, and one of the MTs thought that there was a drug overdose, but I didn't have anything in me. And so because the assumption was that it might be a drug overdose, by the time they got to the hospital, they couldn't give me anything because they didn't know what was already in my system. So I can remember that they stopped. There was a flurry of activity. They worked on me. I remember one of them saying that my eyes were fixed and dilated. And they covered me over with a sheet. And I thought to myself, I'm not dead. You know, you don't have to do that. And they wheeled me right on out, put me in the ambulance. And once inside the ambulance, then I was uncovered. And I remember that I saw the fellow. There was a man in front. There was another one in the back with me. And he reached up overhead, and out of an overhead cupboard, pulled out a couple of blankets to kind of wrap around me. Now, what he didn't know was that I wasn't laying there on the gurney looking up at him doing this. I was like a speck on the back of the wall, you know, over the door, where I could see everything. The vision that I was, you know, that I had, was I was outside my body, and I could see what was going on. At some point, I was slightly above the ambulance as we're whizzing through town. I thought all ambulances going had whirling lights and sirens. And this one had no whirling lights or sirens. So I'm busy watching the businesses and this kind of thing whiz by, and we're going at a pretty good clip. Well, we got to the emergency room, they pulled up in front, and they had me in the gurney. The two of them got out. There were people from inside the hospital. And I don't know how many of you have ever been in a hospital emergency room. It is total organized chaos. I don't even begin to know how to explain it any other way. Some of the doctors here will know exactly what I'm talking about. And those of you who have ever had the opportunity to experience it, I don't have to tell you. So at any rate, they're coming out of the hospital. They're assuming that it's a drug overdose. They get me in. Now, by the time they got me to the hospital, my heart had already stopped. And so they went to work on me. And they were in the process of resuscitating, you know, or pumping my chest or this kind of thing. And once they got me going again, because they thought it was a drug overdose, the problems that I was having with the seizures, they put you onto a gurney, or they have you on a gurney, and your head is tipped back, and they jam a tube into you to open up the air passageway. This is what they were doing for me. Well, so the doctor had the tube. They had my head tipped back. They were pushing the tube in. Somebody had already taken blood from my arms because they were looking to see what there might be in my system. Do any of you know what a big bore angiocatheter is? It's something that's probably about as big, I don't know, but the scars are still here, both of my arms, where they wound up putting those in, you know, at some point in there so that they could get the fluids into the heart faster. but they took the blood out to take it and take get it to the lab to go have it checked. While they were doing that, they're still at the same time trying to open up my air passageway so that I can breathe, so I can, so they can kind of sustain my life. Someplace along in here, as he was pushing that tube in, it caught. And so he pulled it out, pulled it up, and he jammed it back in again. And the EMT standing there that was busy with him and beside me said something to the effect of, like, ouch, I bet that hurt. And the doctor says, oh, she's out of it, said she can't feel it. And you know what? He was right. I could not feel what he was doing. I was outside my body and probably about the distance of this podium away from him watching what he was doing to me. And you know what? I quickly lost interest in it because as I kind of looked up, I started moving and there was this grassy field. Now, I had really no great concern for the body that was laying there on the gurney. And I knew that there was a part of me that was there, but it really didn't matter because the alive part of me was moving. And as I went into that grassy field, I noticed off to my right that there was kind of a river that went through. There was an embankment that went down. It was beautiful. There was a music, like nothing I can describe here on this earth, that kind of wafted through everything, through the grasses, through the millions of little tiny white flowers that lay through the grasses, through the bushes, the trees. It's almost as if everything that existed carried a sound. And all of that sound kind of wafted together, and it blended together, and it was a part of me, it was through me, it was out of me. It was the most peaceful thing that you can imagine. Along the water's edge, there were probably somewhere about 5 to 7 people, and I knew that they were there waiting for me. Someone looked up and noticed that I was coming. I was dressed in something that was long and white and flowing. I was moving across the ground rather rapidly. My hair was down shoulder length. My hair has never been any longer than what it is right now in my entire life, but it was long. And I felt such a peace. I felt such a fullness, such a completeness as I moved along, heading toward this group of people that I knew were going to take me across that water if I decided to go with them. And I knew that if I did go with them, I would never come back. So there was a man kind of leaning against the tree in a big sweeping motion. I was like, hurry, Elaine, you know, everyone's waiting. And 2 women broke away from the group and they came running toward me. Now, I have to tell you that they were in the prime of their life. If you can imagine, somewhere about 20, 30 years old, young people that have more energy than I ever had. You know, this is the appearance that they were there. And yet I recognized them and I knew who they were. When one got close enough to me, I realized it was my dad's mother. And she had passed away when I was about 10 years old. When the other one came a little closer, she was my husband's Aunt Virginia. And Aunt Virginia had just passed away the previous February. And here she was. She was crippled in life. She probably barely stood 4 feet or 5 feet tall. She was more like about 4'10". Just a little tiny wisp of a woman. She had one leg that was probably about 3 inches shorter than what the other one was. She walked with a real decided limp. And here she was coming. She was just as perfect as anything that I have ever seen in my life. Full of health. They just looked great. And I just thought, wow, if my kids could just see this. Because Aunt Virginia was there when the babies were born. She was there when canning time came. She lived 2 hours away from us, and for whatever excuse or reason that she could possibly think of to put egg money into the gas tank, they were at our house on weekends, and we just flat out loved them. She never had a daughter, and my husband was her favorite nephew, so she spent an awful lot of time at our house. I was just astounded at what I was seeing. I could not wait. She was no further from me than the second row here, and arms outstretched. I was ready for the hug. And just that quick, I was dropped. It felt like ceiling height back into a body on a gurney in an emergency room. and the defibrillator paddles were above me, and they were raising the jewels to come in for another jolt. And let me tell you something, the movies don't do it justice. When defibrillators are used to give your system a jolt, the best thing I can tell you is to remember the worst Charlie horse you ever had in your life. And think about that Charlie horse is taking over your entire body from the crown of your head to the soles of your feet. And it's a hard, hard knock. And so they hit me with it again. I felt my body jerk. And, you know, then my heart was going. And there's all this flurry of activity. Somebody is hollering that there's nothing in my blood. And they say, go back and check it again and put a rush on it. You know, so here's all the commotion that's going on in the hospital emergency room. And so they assigned someone to me, because what was happening was that the vein had ruptured in my brain. It had put about a half a teaspoon of blood into the cranial cavity, which causes stress. Any time that there's blood, anything in there besides brain fluid, it causes stress to the brain, which causes lack of oxygen. It affects the heart defibrillates. It is a cycle that, unless it's turned around within about a 30 to 40 minute period, the kindest thing that you can possibly do is let the person who's going through it go ahead and pass away, because they've lost so much oxygen, there's no way in the world that they could possibly ever be anything more than a vegetable. And this is what they had determined for me. The full explanation of all of that too is in here if you decide to read it. For those of you who do have the book, there's a whole medical thing in here, and I can go through that after that. So with someone that was assigned to me, shortly they would say, here she goes again, she's having another one, or grab her quick. You know, and there would be this whole flurry of activity around me. I mean, at one point I can remember being up somewhere above a person that was straddling me on the gurney, and they were just pumping away on my chest. You know, another time, it's just, you know, all this flurry of activity. And so how many of these things that I went through, the only thing that I do know is that someplace along the line, I remember seeing a time clock. Board there, I was just like at eye level with it, and I remembered that the last thing that I remembered in the hotel room was that it was about 20 minutes after 12. And by 5 after 1, they determined that I had had 11 seizures. How many more beyond that, I have no idea. And how many of them were Pettit seizures, which were small ones, and how many of them were grand mal, I have no idea on that one either. So that's information that I'm not privy to. But at some point there, they had determined, the doctors did, there was a three-car pileup out on an interstate. There were 7 people that were badly injured. There were a couple of them that were children. They were going to need the ICU, you know, the emergency room. It was like all hands on deck, and they put me to one side, and the order was that if she goes again, let her go. And so that's what they did. They put me to one side, and when my heart stopped the next time, they did not revive me. And you know, it was okay, because I was going and I was comfortable. I didn't find the noodle, though. I didn't find a toodle either. But I was heading toward a place that was light, but all at once it was just like as if pea soup fog kind of took over. Think about the worst inversion you've ever seen here in the valley, and that probably comes close. But you couldn't see anything in front of you. And I didn't feel frightened, and I didn't feel strange about it. I just kind of looked to my left, and I didn't feel anything. I was just kind of looking around. And as I turned back to my right, right along about horizon height, there would have been a light that would have been like the biggest harvest moon you probably have ever seen. And as the minute I saw that light, or that round sphere, then everything became dark and my vision became very clear. And as I moved toward it, the light reflected back toward me. And At some point in my rise, it was moving toward me, I was going toward it, I saw movement that was down here in my peripheral vision. And as I looked down, here was maybe someplace about 200-300 people, at least a crowd every bit as big or bigger, twice as many people, that were in this area, all of them looking down, kind of shuffling. And the only way I can kind of describe this is if you could think of the one thing that would maybe depict it the best would be the lack of love and just total confusion. They didn't know where they were. They were all kind of aimlessly circling about, you know, shuffling about. And they just seemed so hopelessly lost. And I remember as I looked down to them, and all I could see of them was just the light that reflected across the top of their heads and maybe their shoulders. I thought, you can go the same way I am. All you have to do is look up. There's the light. And as I looked back, the light was much, much bigger because it was probably no bigger or no closer to me, no further from me than what the back row is here along the glass. And in this light was the figure of a man. Now, the man was kind of turned like this. And the minute I saw him, I recognized who he was. And I thought to myself, oh my, I'm not worthy of this. And I fully expected him to just keep on turning and turn his back on me, because suddenly I could remember everything in my life that I had ever done. You know those stories that you hear about your life passes before your eyes? Believe it. I could remember the times that I had been ornery with my kid brother. I could remember the times that I had done things and let him take the blame for them. None of you have ever done that. I know. I can remember the time when I found a whole sixth sense that was laying on the floor, and I was a little kid, and so I could remember another time when there was a piece that was just underneath the bedroom window, and how that nickel got in there, I have no idea, but I remember I fussed with it until I got it out, but I had that money, and you know what? Back in those days, 6 cents could buy an awful lot. You could get ice cream for 3 or 4 days on 6 cents. That's the time when you could go to school and you could pick it up for something like 2 cents or an ice cream bar. That kind of dates me, I know. So I thought of all those kind of things, and I thought of how unworthy I was, and I thought of how, you know, I had been the oldest child in a family, and my parents had split up, and I couldn't keep us together. I thought about my marriage that had failed. I couldn't be a good wife. I couldn't hold my marriage together. I thought about all the things that I had ever tried in my life, and I had never been a really great success at it. And, you know, if you want to take and just use yourself as a whipping post, that's exactly what I was doing. And then I thought about the abuse that I went through as I was a child, and the trauma that I had gone through, both at the hands of my mother and my father. And, you know, my mother she had been raised in a very Victorian, she was very strict. You know, this kind of thing. And that's not all bad. But, you know, for a small child, it was really, really hard for me. And as I thought about all of these things, this man that I thought was going to turn instead put his hand down. And as he dropped his hand, all of the light that was around him, just like a whoosh, was around me. And I can't even begin to tell you the depth of the love or the caring that I felt at that particular point. And I was made to understand that all of these things, yes, had happened, but the abuse and those kind of things had happened against my will. And so I was not held responsible for that. And that God loved me no matter what. No matter what I could ever do in my life, no matter how bad I ever thought that I myself was, no matter how big a mistake that I had ever made, He was still there, and heaven still loved me. And so I had a chance. And so, you know, the minute the seconds that I felt that love and felt infused with such a depth of it, my mind just exploded with questions. I wanted to know why. I wanted to know why rich and poor. I wanted to know why war and peace. I wanted to know why the deaths of babies. I had a zillion questions that I could think of. I mean, they just tumbled out of my being. And kind of, in a chuckling, I would have all the answers to that. But it was also my choice and whether I wanted to go back, because I knew that my body was back there on that gurney in an emergency room waiting for me. And if I wanted to go back to it, I could. But if I wanted to go on, I could do that too. And so my thought was, I really wanted the answers to the questions, and he allowed that I would be able to know those. So we moved on ahead, and as we moved forward, it's as if, you know, you see this room and it's kind of open and kind of in a round venue, but it was dark. But ahead of us was like a white lit wall. And the only way I can think of to try to explain that to you would be if you had your living room, huge picture windows that would be covered with white curtains. That would be very close to describing to you the kind of light that would be coming through that white wall from the opposite side. There were people that were in the forefront, and they were people that were men. And these were like the apostles and the great men of the Old Testament, like Moses and Isaac and Jacob. And then there were names that I didn't know and didn't recognize that were in there. But all of them were there, and they were working for the betterment of mankind. And as I moved forward, the man that I met to begin with was here. He was tall. He wore a white that goes beyond anything that I know how to describe. And for the first time in my life, I saw color in white. And I always thought white is like your white shirt, you know. You don't see color in the white that you wear. Look at it. But the white that I saw from him radiated almost like an aurora borealis kind of. There was a color that went from, and the color moved out ahead of him. He was here. And by comparison, what I had, I'm going to be more like an eggshell color. It was kind of dingy. It just didn't look all that bright and white. And, you know, but up to that point, I thought, you know, what I was wearing was pretty well white. And it worked pretty well. When we got to the curtain, after we stopped here and there and talked to different ones that were in the room, and, you know, I remember at one point they were saying, but I really don't want to go back. If I go back, I'm just going to mess up again. I really wanted to go on. And yet in the back of my mind and my thinking, I had three little girls at home. My youngest one was like 4 years old at that point. My youngest one was. My oldest one was someplace about 10, 11, 12, someplace in that time frame. And so I was so torn because I wanted to be here and keep on going where I felt so totally alive and so completely whole. And the other part of me wanted to go back and watch my children grow up and to be a part of their lives. And then I came to understand that it wouldn't make any difference whether I was there or here, you know, that I would still have an effect on their lives, that I would be able to influence their lives either direction. Many of us think that the spirit world is way off someplace else, and it's not. It's right here in this room. If you knew how many unseen spirits were in here besides just those of us who are here, it would amaze you. Because each one of us have beings that are there from the spirit world that are loved ones who have passed on, who are angels who look out after us. They're there. You know, there's those times in your life when you have felt like that there's, let's put it a different way. Somebody who has passed on that's been very close to you, how many times, maybe afterwards, it might be a brother or brother, a mother, your brother, your sister, you know, whoever, a good close friend, and you might be doing something just out of the blue, and you'll feel, and you'll think, you'll have them on your mind so intently that it's as if you can feel them right there with you. I've done that already to the point where I've turned around looking for them. I heard Aunt Virginia's voice 3 days after she had passed away. I was in my kitchen washing dishes, and I heard a voice, and her voice called me Elaine from the front room. Now, the only other person in the house was my little girl, and she was in bed taking a nap. There wasn't another soul. But it was definitely Aunt Virginia. So these kinds of things, I remember on one time after my father passed away, and I remember my middle daughter, she gave me a call, and she said, I've been thinking a lot about Grandpa today. She says, I just can't get him out of my mind. Well, it was kind of strange, because I had been fussing around in the flowers and stuff, and my dad was a great dirt digger. He liked to get in there and fuss and play in the dirt, too, and grow just whatever his fingers would put together. This was my dad. And so, as I had been, you know, doing the same sorts of things, I had him attentively on my mind, almost to the point where I really thought I could turn around and find his fingers in the dirt right along with mine. But it didn't happen that way. So that's the kind of thing that I'm talking about. You can feel them many times. Sometimes people see them. Sandy is a great resource here because she has done so much research in this field that, you know, she's good to have on the board here. She's good to be able to be here and talk to you. As we went on and we went through this white wall of light, there was this darkness that lay out there. But there was another man. And I thought about this man, my understanding would be like he would be the king of all the angels. If you could think of a top dog, this guy was it. And as I was taken to him, I was left to be to understand that the questions that I had, he could answer for me. And if I decided to stay, then the original being would be back and would take me on. And if not, then it was understood. I was also let to know that even though that I did not want to come back, that I felt really torn in what I was doing, that if I did come back and I could give the love, even a fraction of what I felt there, to just one person, then my purpose for coming back would have been fulfilled. You never know what it means to somebody to just say, hi, hello, how are you? Are you having a good day? And genuinely mean it. Because that genuineness is what's felt on the other side. It's that communication that comes from your heart. The things that you do for no reason, not for anything that you ever think of risk for reciprocation. It's just that part and parcel of you that gives from your heart, that gives from your soul. That's what's felt on the other side. So I had that to kind of weigh around in my mind too. Now, this angel that I thought of, I don't remember that he actually had a name, except that I wanted, you know, when I came back from my experience, the name Michael meant an awful lot to me. And I can't tell you why Michael meant an awful lot to me, but that's what I kind of attached to this personage. And as he wanted to show me something, he would just kind of raise his hand in a particular position, and that whole area would come alive with whatever it was that he was wanting to show me. So it would be like being in front of a group like you, and whenever he wanted to show me something, and there were people involved, they would be every much or more alive than what you are. So it's not like looking at a flat screen. You're seeing and you're interacting with those around you. So when I asked the question about why do children have to die, and why are they born? Why? I mean, if God is such a great God, why would he bring such a pain to a mother who loses a child? And why do there have to be deformities? Why the disabling? You know, things that we see here on this earth. And he just kind of gave me a half chuckle. Well, you know, they came to earth, or at least they gained a body. You know, I'm not saying it exactly as he said it, but he was just allowing me to know that in however they came, they at least had gained a body. And, you know, somewhere along about that period of time, I was able to view as he raised his hand, I saw a group of people. I'm kind of stumbling over this because I don't know how to best put it in perspective. But as he kind of raised his hand in that particular direction, there was maybe about 20 to 30 people that were coming toward us. And they were young and vibrant, and they were carrying on conversation back and forth with each other, and they were happy and laughter. And you could just feel this energy exuded off of them. And then he allowed me to know that every last one of them would come into this earth as disabled, handicapped people. And within my lifetime, I would meet them all. And then it's as if they came to about the distance of what the back row is here, and they were still animatedly talking to them. But there were three of them, two that I saw in closer, a little boy about 10 years old, and a little girl that looked like she might have been about three with blonde hair. Little boy stood with his hands kind of down and tucked behind him, you know, just sort of down to his side, but I didn't see his hands. And you could tell, I could tell by looking at both of them, that they had some mental incapacity and that neither one of them would be able to think very far or to be able to grasp life like what, you know, most people might. And so as I'm looking intently at those, I'm realizing these same two individuals were also one of the vibrant people that were you know, in behind this line to the back. But this is how they would look when they came to the veil on this side of it, here in the earth. And as I stood there, there was a woman, I can only describe her as having kind of bright golden hair. And she had in her arms a baby. And this baby looked totally normal to me. I knew it was a girl. She laughed and giggled. She had the biggest blue eyes I've ever seen on a child in my life, on anybody as far as that part goes. She had the longest eyelashes, and I could not see anything in her that appeared to be disabled, deformed, nothing. Not like I could see with the other two children. And she allowed me to know that this little girl would live all of her life as an infant. And without ever speaking a word, her life would touch thousands of people. She would live all of her life without a brain. And I thought, you know, when you come out of something like this and you lay in a hospital bed for days afterwards and you try to rationalize what you've been through and you try to make sense of it, I thought, well, okay, maybe I might see the two handicapped kids, but a baby without a brain, you know, how in the world could it possibly exist? And I was left to understand that within my life, when it came to a point where I would be making a decision that would govern the rest of my life, it was like a turning point that would happen somewhere about 15 to 20 years out in my life, that I would meet all three of these individuals. And so, you know, the scene stated they were gone, and I wanted to know, another thing that went along with it was my understanding that those with these kind of deformities that were born with these kind of disabilities had also been very stalwart, very strong, spiritual people, spiritual beings on the other side of the veil. And we're going to go back because look back in the very beginning of time when there was a decision for the earth to be formed here. And when this earth was formed, that the inhabitants would be put up on it. And, you know, there was a point in time there when Lucifer wanted to take all of the glory, and he would make sure that all of these beings, all of these people, made it back to Heavenly Father. And all he wanted was the glory and the pat on the back for it. I'm just kind of paraphrasing it, but those of you who know your scriptures know what I'm talking about. And the Lord stood and said, but all the Father, you know, to his Father, he would be very happy to come. And he would lead the people and he would teach them, but he would give them their free agency. He would give them their agency to be able to make the choices themselves and decide for themselves whether they wanted to follow them and come back. Or whether they wanted to, you know, follow a different pathway. And so when the decision was made that our Lord Jesus Christ, or that this spiritual entity would be the one to come to this earth to carry the weight of the world on his shoulders, Lucifer was escorted out of that heavenly realm. And he was given the dominion of the darkness, you know, to be able to, this was his space, this was his place. You know, he could never gain a physical body like what you and I have. But those that were deformed, that had the crippled up bodies, that had the lack of capacity and are born this way, or those that become disabled through no fault of their own, you know, after they have come to this earth, these are the ones who escorted him out. And they enter this earth in a disabled body, and here they can't be attacked. They can't be held responsible. And I thought, you know what? What a loving Heavenly Father we have to be able to put that into some kind of perspective, you know, for me. Because I never could understand it. Once it was put together in that kind of light, then I understood. And the compassion that I feel today for those who are less fortunate than perhaps I am is immense. It's just immense. And I was also given to understand, you know, as I looked out, I could see down below us, the earth. You know, it's like he could point a direction, and I could see where the earth was. And it was like as if it had a cloudy all I could say is it's like a dirty cloud, you know, that kind of went around it. I don't know how else to explain it. But as I would look up, I could see the spheres of two, what I termed at the time, looked like moons, because I didn't know what else to describe them. And I understood that at a given point in time, this dirty planet would become something so much brighter than either one of the two that I was looking at above me. And it was at that point that I came to understand the capacity of the heavens and the love that goes even deeper for us from an all-loving God who gives us the chance to be able to live our lives the best way that we know how, to do the very best we can. And we have to make the choices that are going to get us to whatever level that we need to be. Now, while my experience is going on, and I'm laying in the hospital, this little nurse who has never watched anyone die is cleaning me up. And they had already put the gauze over my eyes, and they had red taped my rings to my fingers, my earrings to my ears, and this kind of thing until somebody in the family could come and claim my body. They were preparing me for the morgue. And don't you know that they had already sent for a priest to come in and pray my last rites, and no priest could be found. There was no one in the hospital that night. And I remember that as I was there in kind of this, how shall I say it, third person, being able to see what was going on, I saw a young man walk in, and the doctor asked if they'd found anyone yet, and he said, no. He said, well, then you better send to an outside parish. And he said, this was just before they had, you know, that my heart had actually stopped the last time. He said that they weren't going to be able to keep me together much longer. Well, after my heart had stopped and they had worked on me, they were preparing me for the morgue, there was a priest. Actually, he was a deacon, but as far as I was concerned, he was a priest who came wandering in. He just wanted to see if there was anything going on in the emergency room, and of course I was there. And when he talked to the nurse who was taking care of me, he let her know, or she let him know, that I had been gone about 15 to 20 minutes, that the doctors had done all they could do, that there was nothing else. And he had some concern because he was afraid that perhaps my system had shut down. Don't whisper now. Yeah, it kind of hums. I was concerned that my system had passed on, that my spirit had passed on, and maybe it had gone too far to be able to hear his instruction as he prayed the last rites for me. Now, as a child, growing up, I had decided long ago that if the fundamental church that I had grown up with was the only thing that was out there, then I wasn't so sure I wanted any part of a heaven that had people quite that noisy. And so surely there had to be some place that was a little bit quieter. Stanley Sobrinsky remembered our experience. I'm going to read this from the book because it's short. He said, I recall Elaine's case pretty well. He was absolutely shocked, by the way, when he came into the hospital room 2 weeks later and found me there in the bed. I waited for days to hear my priest's voice. And if you were Catholic in Mercy Hospital, you had a cross pinned to the foot of your bed. Well, I didn't have a cross pinned to the foot of my bed, but my roommate did. And she, you know, every morning the priest would come in, he would give her communion, and he would pray with her, and then he would leave the room. Well, in order for him to come in, he'd have to go past my bed to go over by the window to talk to her. Now, she'd had a stroke that affected her voice, so I knew she couldn't tell me. But I used to pull myself up on my bed, and I was partially paralyzed on my right side. I'd suffered a mild stroke through all of this. And so they had me pretty much bedbound. And, you know, just the humor of this, I hated it. Just absolutely hate. They're cold, they're miserable. I hated bedpans. Those of you who have ever experienced them, you know what I'm talking about. I don't have to explain. So I found out that I could pull myself up on the traction bar, and I could ease myself over the side of the bed. A chair next to the bed that sat between the wall had wheels on it. I could get in that, scooch around the corner, work myself onto the stool. Right? Well, it didn't take very long for the nursing staff to understand or to figure out that my input and my output didn't match. And one day, they caught me. And then she let me know that any time after that I needed help, that I should give them a call. One of them would come and help me out. Anyway, when Stan Sobrinsky came into the room on that particular morning, I felt kind of miserable. And as I lay there with my eyes about half closed and kind of find a comfortable position to get into,
I heard his voice, and I opened up my eyes, and I could not believe it, because here was the dark-haired, dark-rimmed glasses personage that I remember praying my last rites, and I remember watching him pray and feeling the power of the prayer. And, you know, this is to let you know, too, that it doesn't make any difference what church, what faith, what background, who you are. All of your prayers go to the same place, and our Heavenly Father hears them. And, you know, when you're the person that's going through the trauma, you can feel the power of the prayers of those that are raised. Now, if I could feel it in my humble state, what much more does our Heavenly Father feel? It was wonderful. Anyway, he came into the room, and as he was getting ready to leave, I asked him if it was possible he could have been in the emergency room a few weeks before. And he says, oh, I might have been. He says, why, were you there? And I said, yeah. They brought me in on what they thought was a drug overdose. And he's all the time, he's looking for that cross on the foot of my bed, which wasn't there. And then he looked up at me, and he recognized me, and he said, but you're dead. I said, no. Something did happen to me, though, and I'd like to talk to you about it. I've been waiting for a religious personage to come in, and because there's so much more than what I can even begin to tell you tonight, and the book probably holds maybe a tenth of it. And we can go on, I'm going to leave some space for questions and answers, and I hope that you'll ask them, and I'm going to hit over a few things here that give you something to ask questions on. But I told him about having seen him and about his dark rimmed glasses and things that he said, and I repeated them, and this is what he had to say. He said, I recall Elaine's case pretty well. I was a deacon in the Catholic Church over at Mercy Hospital in Chicago, and I was on call that day when the call came in that there was a dead on arrival and would I go up and see what I could do. So I went up and met the nurse and asked what seemed to be the problem, and she said this lady was brought in as an overdose. I asked how she was doing, and the nurse said, well, we tried everything, but she's gone. That's all there is to it. She just didn't make it. And I was concerned because I was told she'd been dead for 15 to 20 minutes, and I wanted to pray with her. I went ahead then and performed my duty, which I did with everybody when I was called in, and I said certain prayers, and I whispered in the ears of the so-called deceased. So I whispered in her ear, and I asked if she could hear me, and could she maybe make a sign or squeeze my finger or whatever, but, you know, there was no sign whatsoever. I checked her neck for some sign of pulse, and I looked for some indication of breath in her nostrils. Those are easy to see, as close as I was to her, but there was just nothing. She was absolutely limp and lifeless. So I completed my prayers and I blessed her, and that seemed to be the end of that. I then spoke to the nurse and told her I had completed my part and asked her what she was going to do next. She had already taken off all the life-saving mechanisms and had taped the woman's rings to her fingers and her earrings in place in her ears, which they did so the items wouldn't get lost in the morgue. And after that, her eyes would be gauzed and taped and so forth, and she would be covered with a sheet, and then she would be taken to the morgue. Then I left the room, and that was that. I knew she was gone, dead. Then when I got back, I think maybe a week or two later, I looked in one of the beds, and I thought, oh, my God. So I said to this woman, Elaine Durham, what happened to you? You were dead. She looked at me kind of funny, and she says, no, I'm not dead. Yes, yes, you were. Now, I have to tell you something. This man was likely coming. He was just coming out of his skin. Because he knew that I was dead. He was there with me. He knew that I had been gone 15 to 20 minutes. You don't come back after something like that. He said, I'll be honest about it. I knew it was the same person I'd said the last rite for and that she had been dead. So we got into a little conversation about this and that. I remember that she seemed to want to talk, though I don't remember much about the exact conversation we had. I was just amazed, for I knew that she'd been dead, and here she was, alive as she could be. It was completely beyond my ability to understand, and I was upset about it for some time. I asked her if she had been told that she was dead, for she was. There was no two ways about it. And here she was, with no brain damage or anything. Now, I've been in on many, many deaths, and that's the only time I ever ran across something like that. So the hospital staff brought in my lunch. He left because he had other patients, you know, other people that he had to share communion with and this kind of thing. And when he came back after that, then we sat and we talked and talked and talked. And I told him the things that I could remember. And I knew because I'd overheard somebody in the hallway discussing me that I had brain damage. I also knew that I had short-term memory loss. I was scared to death that I was going to forget the things that I saw. I was afraid that I would forget the knowledge that I had been given. And so I really sought for understanding, and I thought perhaps if I told this priest all of these kind of things that he would remember, you know, the things that I was scared to death that I was going to forget. I started drawing pictures. There was a place that this angel took me to that was inside of a mountain, and all I can remember at one point was the exterior of the mountain with tall stones. Now, I can remember that we kind of stepped into a shadow, if you will, and then the next thing that I can remember beyond that is the stone steps that kind of went down. We traveled these stone steps that went down, and there was a room, but the as we got down to the bottom of the steps, it was like a mezzanine, for lack of a better way to try to explain it. There were doors, but they were doors just like lines in the wall, no handles, no way for that door to open, no hinges that I could see. And there was a space that probably would have been, oh, maybe for my hand, 2 feet or better, that went up and around it with carvings that would be in the stone. And it would be better than sheaves of wheat. It was so much more. There were markings that it wasn't like the petroglyphs that we would see or the hieroglyphics out of the Egyptian, you know, but there was things that were written around that door and around the other door. So dead in front of us was like a double door, and to the side there was a single door. And I was so fascinated with what I was seeing carved into this stone that I was surprised when I heard the door next to us open. It was just almost as if, and all this was instantly, I mean, it happened so quickly. But the door opened as if whoever was on the other side knew that we were on the opposite side, and we went in. But I was not allowed to go any further than just inside the door because I wasn't dressed properly. Now, all of them that were in there had on something that was long and flowing and white, and they had on like an over, if you could imagine, like a vest that would come down around knee length. And they were busy working, and there was a long table that sat out in front of us, and I don't know how to explain it to you except to tell you that a couple of years ago, it's probably been 5-6 years ago, I happened to be in England and went to the library there, and upstairs they had records and books that dated back centuries from different countries. And in this was thick parchment. And the thick parchment, when the ink would hit, it would cause the paper to kind of crumble. You know, not crumble, but crinkle. And so it's a thicker kind of a paper. And that's the only thing that I can think of that even comes close to what I saw there. So there were records to the left of the room, to the left kind of center of the room. There was a huge stone. And the stone came up probably somewhere about 40 inches or so in height. And from my viewpoint standing just inside the door, it would have looked like it might have been granite at the bottom. But as it rose up, it would have been more like what crystal would be, like raw crystal. If you've had the opportunity to be able to see that. There was a light that emanated from that. If I could explain it any other way, it would be almost as if it were a living water that was in it. There were things that were going on, people that were standing looking into this rock, and they were writing things down. There were beings, people, that were going from the table to there. They were collecting whatever was written down, putting it on the table. There was a lit room that was to the side, and people were coming from there, picking them up off the table and going in and entering these things into a permanent record. So there was someone in front of me. There was like, for lack of a better way of putting it, like a closet that was here. And as this man looked at me, he reached in to get something out of the closet. And as he pulled it out, he looked at it, and he looked at me, and he said, no. And he put it back, and then he brought out a different one. So then I had the robe, or if you will, this elongated vest that was put over me, over what I had was existing wearing. He checked a belt, a sash that I had around my waist, to make sure that it was where it was supposed to be. And then, almost as if on cue, the angel who had been with me, who was in the center of the room discussing, he knew just the second that I was properly dressed. He turned, he came back and got me and took me to the rock. Now, this is almost like a peephole into another world, because I was able to see into this and see things that were from centuries ago, back to almost like a premortal state, to some things that are advanced way out in the future. And as I looked into this, and I was just so fascinated with the things that I saw, as I glanced up, I realized that everyone around that huge rock, which would be like about three king-sized beds put side by side, it was just a big, huge rock, they all were seeing things different, and they were all making notations on what was happening. So looking into this, I saw things that would be pertinent later on in my life for my own knowledge. And you have to understand that each person who goes through an experience like what I have gone through, the information they get is for themselves. If in my sharing it tonight your hearts are blessed, then that's the reason I'm here, and that's why I would share it with you. But in no way will I tell you that you have to live by the precepts or by the principles, you know, that I learned, things that I had to live my life by. And so looking into this and seeing these kind of things, looking into the future, I saw the fact that I probably would not raise my own children, and I had three daughters. I knew that my illness was going to go from bad to worse. I realized that in coming back to my body, there was going to be an awful lot of heartache. But at the same time, my understanding was that in this, there was a knowledge, knowing that my life would be so much blessed because of what I had been through, and I had that sure, certain knowledge of a future that went on beyond what this life is here on this mortal earth. So we have that. We have that to look forward to. Now, in the interest of time, because time is getting away from us here rather quickly, I'll tell you how I came back. They had fixed me up. They were waiting for people from the morgue to come up and claim my body and take me downstairs. And I remember that I had made the decision that, yes, I would return. And I remember waking up. I'm in my body on this gurney. I was so cold. I was so stiff. I couldn't move anything. And I thought to myself that I had to be paralyzed. And I couldn't understand why on earth God would let me come back into a body that was paralyzed, that I could do absolutely nothing with. I couldn't take care of my family. I couldn't take care of myself. I mean, I couldn't move. And I remember being so sad, because I thought, what a hopeless existence this is. I was worse off than the people that I had seen in my vision that were disabled. And I can remember hot tears. I can just remember the hot tears going down the side of my face. And all at once, I heard a gasp out of a nurse. And it was more than, oh my God. And she was just out of there. And I heard her feet running across the tile floor. And she was going for help. This person that was dead was alive. And she knew, because she had been with me the whole time, that I should not be alive. I shouldn't be moving. I shouldn't be anything. Well, I couldn't move. And so she went, and not a loud scream, but she was very excited. And she was going for help. And I will bless the nurse who came back with her. There were three other people besides her. And the one that was in charge, you know, immediately reached for my wrist. They knew that I was here. She started removing the gauze from my eyes. And I could not close the left eye. It was open and it wasn't going to close. And so she quickly put drops into it. And then she was telling them all in the same. She's telling me that I'm fine. Even before she takes the gauze off my eyes, she's telling me that she's there with me. She's not going to leave me. Everything is going to be okay. They're going to take care of me. And at the same time, then she's telling them to get the warmers. And so here's nurses that are bringing in warm blankets, and they're putting them over me, and they're not enough, and I'm still cold. And so she's sending for more warmers and telling them where to go to. But all in this kind of a melatonin voice, she's saying to me, everything is going to be okay. You're just fine. She said, I'm going to take the gauze off of your eyes. And when she noticed that the eye wouldn't close, she got, you know, ordered some drops, or she had something there right at hand. And they put drops in, and it just turned everything into a greeny kind of a yellow color, you know, with what she had dropped into my eyes. And then she explained to me that she was going to cover the one eye back up because it wouldn't close. And until my body got warmed enough, you know, to where things would, it was protection for the eye. So there's a lot of things that have happened to me, you know, from that point to this one. I know that that the Lord wasn't done with me yet. I know that in my coming back, part of my being here was to be able to take a fraction of that love and share it with people around me. The few doctors that are sitting here in this room tonight know some of the patients that I have taken care of. They know other doctors that I have worked with over the years. And my heart went to the elderly who had no choice but a health care center or to languish at home with no one to take care of them to do. And so my heart wanted to go to them. And so for years in this valley, I did elder and hospice care. And, you know, I can remember in the hospital when I was just yattering to anybody that would listen to me about the being that I saw and the angels that I saw and seeing my grandmother and seeing my husband's aunt and all this kind of stuff. And one day when they were running me upstairs for one more brain test, you know, with electrodes and all this kind of stuff, it was amazing to me because they put me in the room and they put all these electrodes on me and they're working on me. Yet the doctors, the technicians that are in there are wearing space suits, you know, thick lead stuff. And I'm thinking, okay, I can lay here and I can take all of this, but they're wearing these lead protection sort of thing. Well, that was years ago. You know, thank goodness it's a whole lot better today. My point being that I remember when she was taking me upstairs, she says, I'm not going to say that what happened to you didn't happen. I'm just going to tell you you shouldn't talk about it. You know those doctors that are coming in to see you? Do you know who they are? And, no, they were just doctors. I mean, there was a bunch of doctors came in to see you every day. She said, they're psychiatrists. They don't know what to do with you. You have, that I know of, 5 different psychiatrists that's on a team, and they're deciding whether that you are capable of going home and taking care of yourself or whether they should put you in a healthcare facility. Now, you know, in my mind and my being, I knew I wasn't crazy. I knew that what I saw was just as real and more real than what you're seeing me here tonight. And so I knew that if I went through this, and this is years later, we're talking back about 15 years ago. I knew that if I had gone through this and the heartache that I had gone through and the ostracization that you know, people talking about me, the family disowning me, friends didn't want anything to do with me anymore, she'd gone a little bit loopy, that there were other people that would be going through the same kind of experiences that I did. Not necessarily identical to mine, but they would be having them. And, you know, that's fodder for a whole nother beating. Just to tell you some of the experiences that the people that I took care of had before they passed through the veil and went to the other side. I had one little woman that kept seeing children around her bed. I'll give you this one real quick because it's real special. She kept seeing children around her bed, and I was taking care of her, and she used to like sandwiches made out of white bread, white cheese, and ham, and mayonnaise. Not Miracle Whip, mayonnaise. And so I was busy making her sandwich, and as you came in her front door, it's like living room, dining room, and then the family room, and she had was in a hospital bed in the family room. And then there's like a little kitchen that's off the side. So I was standing here at the table, she's just right around the corner from me, and I hear her talking. And she's just come here and see me. Come here. Oh, you're pretty. What's your name? And she's talking away, and she's looking. I stepped around because I thought she was talking to me. And she's just animated at carrying on conversation on both sides of her bed. And come here, what's your name? And she's talking back and forth. And so then pretty soon she says, okay, you come back and see me. And she's taking her little crooked fingers and she's waving them best she can, but she's waving them right up toward the ceiling. And then I was fascinated with what I was seeing, so I just kind of like stepped back into the shadow there where I could see her, but she couldn't see me, so I could observe them, so I could watch all of this. And she carried on this conversation. They went, and she just craned her neck right around, looked my direction. She says, wasn't that little girl pretty? Who is she? And I thought, I don't know. I don't know, Betty, but she knows you. That's why she came to see you. Well, who were the other little girls? Didn't know. I said, but I'm so happy that you were able to see them. I wasn't going to tell her what a nurse had told me. You better not talk about it because they have a room up in Four West for people. But they don't think. Okay. I didn't want that kind of a stigma to fall on her. Well, you know, for the next 2 weeks, She carried on conversation at different times of the day, and always, every time, she would wave into that same corner. Now, there was nothing in that corner. There wasn't even a picture on the wall in that corner that she kept waving to, or in that area of the ceiling. The entertainment center was back this way from her bed. There was nothing there except a table that had a Noah's Ark thing sitting on it. But whenever she talked to these children, she would want them to come and see her. And she told me, I asked her, I said, where did they come from? She said, they come down the stairway. And she points into the corner of the ceiling. They come down the stairway, and I asked her if there's any little boys, and she said, yes, but they stay on the steps. And there's a light at the top of the stairway, and the staircase is white, and it has some gold on it, and there's a lady. And there's a lot of light around the lady, and she's wearing something white. But the little boys like to play on the steps. They don't come down to see her, but the little girls come down. They dance around the bed. And there was 5 little girls, and there were 3 little boys. She knew exactly how many children, but she didn't know their names. So finally, on this one particular night, she was asking, where'd your little friend go? Well, where did he go? There was one missing. And the next morning, we got a telephone call out of Arizona, and her granddaughter had given birth to a grandchild. Do you know, within my heart, I knew that every child she saw was one of her unborn grandchildren, that she would not be able to be alive to see on this side of the veil, but she saw them from that side of the veil as they came to visit her. She stood there and she told me, she said, you know, my dad would just love you. And I said, well, honey, next time you see your daddy, you tell him I can't wait to meet him. And I said, when I get to heaven, I said, you be sure you introduce us. She said, well, he's right there. You know, and it's like 4 feet from me, there stood her dad, but I couldn't see him, but I could only feel, I could feel the love of the Spirit. On one occasion, you know, as the children were born, they would disappear from the children who came to see her. And then when she died, you know, I thought, there's two children, 2 little girls that didn't quite make it. And there was nobody left in the family that was pregnant, that was expecting. And don't you know, she had 1 granddaughter that lived over here in Orem. She had 20 granddaughters. Those little granddaughters today are 17 months old, and they're just as neat as anything you ever want to see in your life. They're the ones we came to see Christmas, and then my husband decided he wanted to live here. I think the twins did it. These kind of things happen. You know, on another occasion, she saw one of the little girls, and she was really concerned about her. She wanted to get her up in bed with her because she was cold. And she turned. By this time, she's comfortable talking to me about these kids. And she asked me if we didn't have a jacket or a sweater or something for this little girl because there was something wrong with her. And she was cold, and she wanted to take her. And I said, well, let me look around and see what I can find. Now, I'm not going to tell her that we don't have anything to fit a spirit child. But the same token, you know, she had a concern for this child. But don't you know that another granddaughter had her, and she was born slightly premature, and she did have some health problems at birth. Today, that little girl is someplace about 5 years old, and she's doing very well. But at birth, initially, she had some problems. These were the kind of things. I can't make this stuff up. There's too much of it that goes on. That's just a one for instance. But I want to pause here and kind of leave it open to you to ask questions for things that I know I haven't covered. And some of you know more of my experience than what I've talked about tonight. But I'll just sort of leave it to you to ask some questions, and I'll do the best I can to answer them so we can get out of here timely. Yes. Did I see? His question is that he wants to know. We can take a break here for anybody who wants to leave and feel comfortable doing it. He asked if the place that I saw, the place that I went to, did I consider this to be heaven? Was it a paradisical place, or how many levels there are to heaven? You know what? I don't know how many levels there are to heaven. I just know that there's multiple levels. And I would not tell you that the place that I went to was heaven. But I wouldn't tell you that it's not a spiritual realm that I needed to be in so that I could get the information that I needed from my own life. Does that answer your question? Okay. Yes. I'm getting into futuristic stuff here now. I almost tell everybody to read the book. You know, as time goes along, geographic things change. Storms, there's earthquakes, there's volcanic activity. Any one of a number of things that can change the geography. And in this one particular area that I happened to see when I first saw the country, it was divided by a large body of water that went down through the middle. And a lot of the California coast, you know, was underwater. I saw huge storms where waves would come in from the shoreline, just wipe out whole cities, whole areas, just take them right on out. I remember that the water table had raised. The water table had raised to the point that islands, as we know them, were buried underwater. I saw huge, I don't know if this is in the book or not, but I saw huge, oh goodness, help me out, what do you call them? The big ice thing. There you go. Big icebergs that were melting because the water temperature, because the Earth's atmosphere temperature was changing, and so they were melting. And as they were melting, it was raising, you know, the water temperature. I can remember seeing people that were dressed in protective clothing because the sun would be hot enough that it could burn them. You know, they could get some severe burns, and they would wear cream and this kind of thing, you know, within their system. It could have been radiation. I mean, there's a lot of things that are there that some of you are probably a whole lot more knowledgeable than I am. I can just only tell you the things that I saw, and I'll leave it to you to, you know, to do the same thing I am. You know, you try to figure out what they are, what they mean. It's been several years ago when I got a telephone call early one morning, like 5 o'clock in the morning, and someone had just heard the early morning news, and icebergs off the coast of Antarctica had broken loose and were melting, and they were big icebergs the size of the state of Rhode Island, and they were floating and they were melting. Now, I was in Utah at that particular time, and I had occasion to go to California, and through California, I can't remember where I stopped, in Nevada someplace, but anyway, I picked up a newspaper, and in the newspaper, it talked about the water level off the coast of Texas had risen by over 8 inches. You know, in the shoreline. So, you know, who's to know what's going to happen? I have, you know, you keep horsing around with what we have. I'm saying you collectively, but people, if they keep messing around with the things that we have, we don't have respect for this earth that's God-given, then expect things to happen. However, if we take care of it, we love this earth and love each other as much as what we should, then those are things that can or, you know, may or may not happen. But I'd say I'd be careful. The iceberg's off of Antarctica. Yes? You know, that kind of came home when I was reading in the script. I was never a scripture reader. I'd been punished by them too much when I was a kid. She asked what I thought about those that I saw that were kind of shuffling around. But I was reading, you remember the verse of scripture? I don't know how many of you are scriptorians and like to read the scriptures. But there's a portion in there where Christ meets the man who is possessed of devils, of demons. And as he goes to cast them out, they ask him not to just send them off. You know, rather, there's the flock of pigs, or the flock is a bad word, but the group of pigs. And so he took them from him, and he sent them into the pigs, and the pigs went running off the cliff. I have come to understand or to believe that every last one of them, because of the different kinds of traumas that I had gone through as a child and growing up, could easily have been attached to me. Now, George Ritchie wrote the foreword for this book, but in George Ritchie's experience, he remembers a point in his experience when he was taken by an angel and he was taken over a bar scene where the guys are, you're standing around the bar and they're drinking and they're smoking, but then there's a separate spiritual, whatever you want to call them, spirits that on this earth did the smoking and did the drinking and did all the things that these guys would do. And as these men or these people would get to the point where they would be obliterated and fall off, then they that left them wide open for whatever spirits that there were that wanted to kind of jump in. You know, so I think that there are those Well, we attract those by whatever kind of life that we ourselves have. And so, you know, for every piece of trauma that we go through, there's something more. That I wouldn't know what. I just thought that they were kind of attached to me. I'm thankful they're not there now. Yes. You know, surprisingly enough, he asked if I read anybody else's books that had to do with NDEs. When Father Sobrinsky came to see me, he asked me if I had ever heard of Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, and I told him no. He wanted to know if I had ever heard of Raymond Moody, and I didn't know Raymond Moody either. And so that night, after visiting hours were over with us, it was all the same day, he came in, he brought me a Catholic medal, he brought me communion, and he brought me a book by Raymond Moody. And I started to read that book, and I thought, well, this isn't like me. I don't see my experience in here. So, no, I didn't. I put, and to this day, please don't tell Raymond, because in later years I met him. I still haven't read his book. And I thought, that's awful on my part, but that's just one of the things. Yes, dear. Yes. Yes. She wanted to know that with the understanding that I have, do I get a better understanding of why people make poor choices? And my answer is yes, I do. We have the agency to make the choices for our lives that we want to do, and right, wrong, or otherwise, we're the ones who make them. And, you know, when we make a poor choice, you can just bet that there's ones on the other side that have made the same kind of poor choices that are hanging around in the, for instance, rafters, before maybe a way to explain it. That are right there with us. I don't know, does that answer your question? Well, you can stop and remember, she wants to know why do we have more people who really choose evil and stuff like that. This is a realm, you know, when Lucifer was cast into outer darkness, this earth and not all with it is part of that outer darkness. There you go. So, you know, he has some influence here, and it's going to be real easy for people who make poor choices to continue making poor choices until somebody like you with your goodness shows them a different way. I don't know that I can answer it any better than that. To the back. In mine, there was a woman that I did meet, and the only thing that I can tell you that I remember out of it at all is the name Elizabeth. But, you know, I kind of like tucked that someplace back in my brain, because she was with me just a short period of time, and she gave me a hug, and I knew someplace about that point that my father wasn't going to be with me, you know, he wasn't going to live all that much longer. Aside from that, I just kind of kept it. Strangely enough, or interestingly enough, when you get into another area of research that has to do with children's experiences, I mean, you can listen to somebody like me expound on something that I had that might be lengthy. But when you get into small children who have had experiences, many times they are met by someone whose name is Elizabeth. So that name is carried across, although I don't have any other, you know, thing that I can attribute it to besides that. Yes, dear. Would I mind doing it? Taking care? Oh, we could be here all night. We could be here all night. One of the things that I found for me that worked is I always thought that I would work with abused kids. That's where my thought was. I even thought that I would probably work with those who had disabilities, and I have to some extent. But my great love has fallen in with the elderly people who thought that, you know, and others around them. When my life became the difference between them being a number in a nursing home or a health care center or being in their own home and being encouraged to take that step to as far on that envelope as they thought that they could go, and maybe just encouraging them to take a step further, that's what I did. And it's not how long their lives would live, but the quality of the life that they had for so long as they lived, that mattered to me. And when they had spiritual experiences, they could feel comfortable talking about whatever they saw. when one fellow that I took care of over here in the foothills kept talking about somebody that no one in his family knew. And finally, a sister in Alaska says, well, I know who that is. She said, that was her cousin. You know, and it was like a second or third cousin that nobody ever really knew about. But, you know, he and Ben got along great. And so he often saw this man. And, you know, they would converse back and forth. For me, it was giving, you know, trying to give quality of life to older, you know, people, doing the hospice work that I did. Trying to make their pain as, you know, or their passing as painless as I possibly could. And the gray sweatshirt. Yes, I have. And it was just about 15 years later. And there was a fellow, in fact, the book opens up with him. He was riding an adult-sized tricycle down the street. And he was passing out sales flyers, which were free. And I felt him coming. My back was to him, but I felt him before I ever saw him. And when I saw him, and as he dropped off the sales flyers and went on up the street, I thought to myself, maybe he might like a job mowing my yard. My mower was broken and this kind of thing, and I thought, well, I'll watch for him next Monday when he comes around. Well, as it turns out, he came to my house on Thursday before Monday ever got there and offered to mow my yard and help me clean the flower beds and that kind of thing. I inherited my dad's green thumb, and I like playing the dirt. But it wasn't until I met his mother, and his mother showed me a photo album, and she was leafing through it, and I saw a little boy that was standing with his hands exactly as I had seen him there. And the reason that Irv, we're great friends yet to this day, he calls on a regular basis. He lives in Florida at this point, but he was born with Apert syndrome. And Apert syndrome, when a baby is born, the head bones are fused together, and so the head grows elongated as opposed to rounding out like what most, you know, children might be. And so the mentality, normally they don't live much, you know, past puberty. And today, Irv is in his 40s, so which is just almost an unheard of thing. The facial features are very flattened. Sinus drainage, he can just barely breathe out of one side of his nose. And he was born without fingers or toes. And so his hands would be like this, and maybe the tops of the fingers might be together. He had had multiple surgeries that had come down in to be able to give him something that he could grip with, you know, to work with. So that's why I would have seen him with his hands. Sometime after that, and this was probably just about 15 years later, I had occasion to be at a lady's house on a Sunday, and she invited me to stay for dinner. And I said, well, I will if I can help you. So I went back to the bathroom to go wash my hands, and I was coming out. She had a hallway full of pictures, and tucked into one of the picture frames is a little snapshot of a little girl with blonde hair pulled back just exactly as I had seen the little girl that I'd seen there. So I plucked it out of the picture frame, and I went in and I asked her who this little girl was. And she says, oh, that's our Jenny. And Jenny had been born prematurely, and she never had the mental capacity much beyond what a 12-year-old was. And today she's about 35, pretty close to it. The little girl without the brain lived to be about 7 years old, and she passed away on my birthday that year. And literally, her life touched thousands and thousands of people. And she could never utter a word. But great blessings in my life. They opened up windows of heaven for me that I didn't think could be opened up. Yes. Pardon? I took training at the University of Utah in gerontology. And that's I went for a certificate in that. Well, it helped me with the older people that I took care of. Aside from that, what you need is a loving heart. Contact your local hospice organization, see what you can do as a volunteer. They're begging for volunteers. I mean, that would go for the rest of you. You were asking, someone over here asked me, what can you do? What kind of love can you get? The nursing homes, the health care centers are begging for anybody who would be coming and willing to push a wheelchair around or to feed someone who can't feed themselves. You know, go over here to Children's Hospital. Go up on any floor. I mean, call and make arrangements, you know, with someone. You'll have to go through a training. With hospice, I went through a local thing with one of the hospitals, and I also got a certificate that way, too, you know, through the hospital, so that I had. And besides that, it's the countless doctors who taught me the hospice nurses who were just absolutely great, and the people themselves who gave with their hearts. It was just endless, endless. Now, yeah. In that realm, it would depend upon, you're talking about the disabled people? Just in general. There's a lot of learning that goes on over there. You know, what we take with us from this side of the veil when we leave this earth is the knowledge and the love that we've learned. You know, the things that we have that we can take with us. And what is really painful is the things that we could have done that we didn't do. And so that carries across. He's asking, did all of you hear his question? What kind of things do the spiritual beings, the spiritual entities do on that side that we don't have knowledge of here? But the ones that I saw, all of them, were in a working capacity, either learning, you know, it's just endless learning and knowledge. And the other thing is whatever they did was for the betterment of mankind. So, I mean, they can reach back and help family members that are left behind, much like my dad, I'm sure, would have loved to have got his fingers in the dirt right along with me that day. Those kind of things. Yes? What? No, but I had an understanding of it. Yeah, I had an understanding. I don't believe that I could have made it through the next years of my life had I not had that kind of knowledge. And it's, you know, we are each one individual people. And we have a loving Heavenly Father that treats us as the individuals that we are. And some people don't have to get a knock on the head or have a brain vessel, you know, burst in there in order to be able to go where I did. But because of the length of my life and because there's someone who, let me put it a different way. Have any of you ever read the poem about the Master Weaver? The Master Weaver is busy up on the top of the tapestry and he's putting together a picture, and all we see from the underside is the threads and the tatters and this kind of thing. We don't see that overall picture of our lives. We just see the pieces. And it's up to us to loop through those and to, you know, one day be able to gain that greater picture. I can't tell you where my life is going. I'm very happy with what I have right now. The opportunity to be here tonight and to see old familiar faces is just absolutely wonderful, and to meet the new ones is just great too. So, you can't talk about God, and it's hard. A psychologist, a counselor, can't talk about God, even though he knows that that's going to be the best thing for the person that's in front of him that's troubled. So it's kind of hard. Now, if you come here a fireside that I do, it's a whole different story, then I'll tell you plenty. Yes, in the red. I would think that the angel that was with me was a pretty good ministering angel. If you want to know about ministering, I don't have great knowledge of that. Yes. That's something I really don't know. She wants to know how much power to those that are departed, how much do they have that they are able to help us or guide us or protect us. I would think that as much as that they are allowed to, or as strong as spiritual beings, that's something that I don't have knowledge of, so I can't give you that. We probably have time for maybe two more questions. I'll go here. Okay, then you connect with her afterward, then please answer her question for her. Any more? To the back. There's a gentleman someplace in this room. I remember when the Oklahoma City bombing went, because it was an area of my vision that I did see bombed out kind of buildings on American soil. And I saw a lot of trauma. That trauma is probably a poor word, but just real calamity that was in the New York area and the Washington, D.C. I saw a space where our entire government, if you will, came to a total standstill, that there was no transportation of any kind that was moving, and the gas prices had just gone completely off. On this particular morning, he gave me a telephone call, and he said, "Are you watching the news?" And I said, "No." He said, "Turn your TV on." And I did. And what I saw was the bombed out building, you know, there in Oklahoma. And you know what kind of sent shivers down me? Because I thought to myself, this was a vision. These kind of things aren't actually really supposed to happen. And it bothered me. This much I can say, and those of you who have friends or acquaintances that may have gone with the 9/11 tragedy, heaven's got a great army building on the other side. I wouldn't want to be in Lucifer's shoes. I really wouldn't. These are stalwart, strong people. I have a very close friend who has his office there in the Lincoln Plaza, and I couldn't wait to finally get a hold of John and find out if he was alive, dead, or what. And for 3 days I couldn't reach him. When he finally answered his phone and called me back, I just about fell over, because on that particular morning he decided not to go into the office. He was going to do some work at home. These kind of things happen. I have no answer for you. Does that... I'm sorry? I was shocked. No, but not surprised. You're right. That's it. Thank you so much for inviting me.